This episode is sponsored by Life Aid. As you guys know, I made a promise to only bring companies on as sponsors whose products I actually use myself and believe in, and Life Aid is no different. I've witnessed a huge reliance on energy drinks by our population, and I totally understand we are chronically fatigued. However, sadly, I've seen the ill effects that come along with these products, whether it's the cardiac arrhythmias and chest pain, the GI distress, the anxiety. And I wanted to find a product that we could use for the same effect, but that would nourish our body instead of harm our body. And that product is Life Aid. One of the things that really bolstered my belief in it was it's the chosen sponsor from the Spartan Race and the CrossFit Games, which I think are two arenas that have contributed very, very well to the health of our nation. But they've taken the natural supplements, whether it's turmeric and chamomile, the vitamin Bs, the glucosamines, and they've put them in the drinks so that they each one of them has an effect. My favorite one for us, the fatigued first responder, military, medical personnel, is the Focus Aid. And they've taken the nootropic supplements. So these are supplements that nourish the brain, that increase brain function without hypercaffeinating it and relying on sugar. And what really appeals to me about this is A, it works. It tastes great as well, but more importantly, it works. You get this mental clarity that was amazing, but you can also unwind at the end of your shift, whether you go back to the station, whether you get off your rotation. And that's important too, because not being able to sleep when you're in your recovery time is extremely frustrating. So you can access all these products at their website, which is lifeaidbevco.com, lifeaidbevco.com. But they wanted to reach out to you guys, our audience. And so they've offered one of two deals, either $15 off a case of Life Aid, which is a 24 pack, which brings the price down to under $2 a can. So you can work with your people in your ER or your station if you want to split it up. The other thing, which actually is even better value, is the subscription, the monthly delivery that they have. You get 10% off, which brings that down even further. Both of those are also free delivery to your doorstep. So you can see there's almost a zero risk with this because they believe in their product. And I'm sitting here telling you because I do as well. So you use the code SHIELD, S-H-I-E-L-D, code SHIELD at lifeaidbevco.com. And if you want to learn even more about this product, then listen to episode 207, where I interviewed the founder of Life Aid, Aaron Hind. Welcome, guys, to episode 237 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and I am so excited to bring to you an incredible woman this week, Olivia Jackson. Now, Olivia's life story is nothing short of incredible, from being born in South Africa, finding herself in the world of modeling, then transitioning to the world of professional Muay Thai in Thailand, entering the stunt world, a horrific near-fatal accident during filming, and then her incredibly inspiring, powerful journey back from that injury to where she is now. So as I always say before we start the interview, please take a moment, go to your podcast app, subscribe to the show, and then leave feedback. But then the big thing is take your social media and share these incredible episodes. Every single week, I have one of these men or women whose story I know is going to inspire people worldwide, and you guys are the key to getting these episodes out. So with that being said, I introduce to you Olivia Jackson. Enjoy. So Olivia, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. So where are we finding you on planet Earth today?
Today I'm in England, in the UK, where my home is.
Brilliant.
In a very small village outside of London, about an hour outside of London.
Fantastic. Now, obviously from your accent, that is not where you were born. So first proper question, where were you born and what was your family unit like when you were young?
Well, I was born in Johannesburg in South Africa, real shithole. But I left there when I was a baby, and we moved to this area called Richmond in South Africa, in Natal in South Africa. And we lived on a small holding, which was like kids' paradise. There was like trees to climb, fruit trees to take a fruit off of nut trees. We spent hours cracking nuts. Huge rockeries with, you know, things to hide in and pretend it's a school or your house or whatever. Loads of tunnels and there's like streams with ponds. Loads of things to swing on, vines and swings my dad made. At nighttime, there was loads of fireflies around. So we used to go around and catch fireflies and put the poor things in jars so that it lights up. But in the morning, they're always dead, poor things.
That's a huge metaphor for many things in life, huh?
Yeah. but yeah, such a cool childhood then. Just playing on the farm, on the weekends. There was loads of the staff on the farm who had their little kids living there. And so we used to play with them, running around and playing, you know, we were swimming in the pool and jumping in mud all day and make slippery slides. My dad had a nursery. So he had loads and loads of very, very long pieces of thick plastic. So we would, on the hills, we'd make a long slippery slide and put some a dishwashing liquid and a hose pipe on it and slide down. Really good fun.
So how much do you attribute later on becoming, you know, a fighter and ultimately a stunt person to just that rugged life on the farm?
Well, I love that lifestyle. I think I'm in my old age, well, 38, I'm going back to that now. All I want to do is live on a farm. And I think maybe it's from that, I don't know, but I've always loved dirt. So, like, if it was motorbikes, I loved motocross. Road bikes, yeah, I liked, but I loved, you know, riding in the dirt. The same with cars. Like, rally driving is so much better for me than, you know, road racing or track racing. Yeah, so I think it's sort of stuck with me. And it also, like, quite a, I don't know what the word is. I think I've always liked the outdoors and what's the word? Like, I'm not a kind of person that like minds getting dirty or minds getting hurt, I guess. So, yeah, plays a part.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, I grew up on a farm myself too, and it's funny you talk about the, you know, riding through the dirt. I think it's a lot more forgiving. Like, you can get flung from a motorbike and actually just roll out of it and be okay, or a horse, or you know. But yeah, on the road, it's not so forgiving.
Yeah, and it's also just so much more exciting on the dirt. There's a load. It's more forgiving when you fall, but there's loads more going on. You know, it's easy to stay in a straight line when you're riding on tar. But it's really boring. But on dirt, you've got to concentrate so much more. And, you know, you're probably getting pinged from side to side. But the fun is if you stay on and keep going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I remember, you know, on the farm doing, you know, donuts and four-wheel skids and all that stuff. And then when, not too long ago, embarrassingly recently, in my suburban house before this one, we had about a third of an acre, and if it was raining, I'd take my car in the back and do donuts in the backyard with my son. And then the neighbors every so often would call and be like, hey, there's some lunatic doing stunts in their car. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll call the police. Thanks.
A few years ago, before I had the accident, when I had two arms and I had a manual car, I had a little, in South Africa, called it a bucky. It's a truck, a pickup truck or a ute or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So I could transport my motocross bike. And I always used to get my mom in the car if I picked her up and went somewhere. And then I'd find a gravel bit. And every time I saw a gravel bit, I'd go onto it and do handbrake turns around it.
Now, you mentioned about, you know, the people helping on the farm. When people from outside, you know, the nation of Africa or the continent of Africa, yeah, there's obviously racism is one of the first things that comes in, or apartheid. What was your perspective as a young girl growing up? Did you see apartheid? Was there normal integration where you were on the farm? What was your experience with that specifically?
Well, yeah, I grew up in like, you know, proper apartheid times. I think Mandela only became president in 1994, which was, I was 13 years old. I actually remember when the first non-white was allowed to come to our school. It was an Indian girl, poor girl. But anyway, that was like, I actually remember that, and I was probably only about 10 years old. So that was quite a big change. On the farm, I mean, I didn't really notice because I was young, but so I had this one of the black staff on the farm. They had this daughter called Golay. I used to love playing with her. She was so cool. But she was absolutely petrified of my mom. We had a long driveway, and my mom used to come driving up the driveway, and you just used to see Golay absolutely bolt, just bolt and run for the bushes and hide in the bushes. It's not, my mom and my dad were really good to their staff, you know, and didn't matter if we're black or white or purple or pink. But I guess the little kids were just really scared of white adults. Really funny. But that was a weird time because there was lots of, at that time, there was lots of fighting in between. And so in South Africa, you have, at the time, two different parties that the black people follow. They're called Inkatha and ANC. ANC is Mandela's party that Mandela was in. And there was loads of fighting between those parties, between the sort of African people. And yeah, lots, we had loads of them over the staff move onto the farm because there was fighting in their sort of townships, which is quite sad. And actually, in the end, we ended up moving away from there because there was just so much fighting, which is quite sad.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's the problem with that hate, you know, that's behind all of that. I mean, obviously, there was horrendous things happening to, you know, so many of the black people there. And obviously, there was that reflex then to a lot of the white people that have been growing up through generations on farms that way. And actually, my step brother-in-law was from there, and they were basically run off their farm. And, you know, again, it's insanity. It kind of reminds me, there was a picture recently on the internet, and it was so cute. And it was these two young boys. One was black, one was white. I think it was here in America. And I want to say they were about 5, 6, maybe. And they both got the same haircut so they could confuse their teacher as a practical joke. You know, so they weren't seeing themselves different at all. And that's what always just blows me away, is that when we're all young, like you were when you were growing up on the farm, there isn't that hatred, there isn't that prejudice, that segregation. And then, you know, that poison starts creeping in as you know, as we grow up, and then we're divided. So I'm always intrigued to hear, you know, people's perspectives from different parts of the world.
Yeah. I mean, people are crazy. Like, they'll always find something to fight about. It's not black and white, it's Indian and black, or black from one area versus black from another area. Like that, now in South Africa, there's loads of problems with, you know, what happened in Zimbabwe, really, really fucking sad, you know, where they gave the land away, and then loads of people, the country's completely bankrupt and everybody lost their jobs. Like, there was absolutely no money. There is still no money in that country. So most of the African people, Zimbabweans, had to try and find work out of Zimbabwe. So a lot of them have come to South Africa because it's close. And now there's lots of problems. Zimbabweans generally are very sweet people, and a lot of them don't drink alcohol, which is a big bonus, because a lot of the African people in South Africa get really tanked on the weekend. They love a big bender, or every single night sometimes. So a lot of people in South Africa hire Zimbabweans because they're really just good workers, you know. And then there's always problems now with the black people in South Africa. They hate the black people from Zimbabwe because they come and take all their work. So they're literally, like, if you're Zimbabwean, can only live in certain areas, and you have to travel in groups, because they just chuck them off trains, stab them in the streets, you name it.
Wow. Yeah, and again, it all comes back from, you know, that hate and that greed and power at the top. Same with the Syrians. I mean, you look at the footage of some of these, you know, what used to be a city that these people are fleeing from. They don't have a choice. And then, you know, obviously then you get this kind of resistance to them sheltering in certain countries. And, you know, the underlying thing is the few are making decisions that are getting themselves extremely powerful, extremely rich, but, you know, these are all victims, and whether they end up becoming bad people because of their circumstances, you know, these decisions that some of these people in power make, there's a domino effect that lasts for generations after that.
Yeah, that's a really sad bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, then back to your early life. Obviously, you end up becoming in a couple of professions where you're using your body as a tool. So aside from actually running around the farm, were there any specific sports that you started playing when you were a child?
Yeah, I did do sports, but I wasn't like completely into any. I used to play tennis, pretty gay, but I did. and then I used to swim. I was a really strong swimmer, but I never really had the focus where, just like complete dedication and pushed my skills to further, to higher levels. I just sort of played with whatever I enjoyed and left it at that. I played hockey, but I was always really shit at hockey. I was always in the B team. and then, just in South Africa, you have to do quite a few sports when you're at school. I think you had to do 2 sports per season, and then any additional ones you could do. You had to do sport pretty much every day after school, which is good. I think I love sports now. But I mainly got like dedicatedly into sports when I left school.
Right. Okay. Now, when you were leaving school, what was your original career aspiration?
Well, when I was in high school, last 3 years of high school, went to a really good forward-thinking school. And they, at that time, it was quite different. But the school was all about, I think their motto was making women. It was an all-girls school. Making women for the real world, or the new world, or something. Real world, I think. So they try to get us to do a lot of work experience and things we wanted to do. And then we had to go like through the whole interview process, obviously pretend, but CV process and all that. And I was just trying to think of things I could do, work experience. And I think I did interior. First I was like, I want to become a vet because I love animals. And then I don't think I did that. I did work experience in interior design, totally random. When I was only a teenager, I was just thinking I was bashing out things that sounded cool. So that was my idea at the time. Really did not think I'd become what I did become.
Yeah. All right. Well, then the first thing you became was a model, is that right?
Which actually started in school because I was at an old girls' school, and there's a boys' school, which is like the adjoining school, the boys' school to ours. They're a very wealthy school, boys' school, and they have lots of, posh people go to school there. So they have all sorts of, they do lots of fundraising for different charities. And once I had a modeling show for some charity, I don't remember what, but they had all these, top designers and things come along. So they asked some of us girls and boys to do the modeling show. I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then they had one to show us how to model walk properly, to walk on the catwalk. They had this top South African model at the time. Her name was Jody. I don't remember her surname. She had ginger hair, I remember. She showed us how to model. And then she said to me, I would do well at modeling. So she thinks I should start. So she gave me some context. My mother said, no, I can't start until I finish school. So, I finished school. By the time I finished school, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. So I just thought, I'm just going to start modeling and see how that goes until I find out what I really want to do. So I started modeling and then just carried on with that, really. Moved to Cape Town on my own, because that's where the biggest industry is. And then started modeling there, and then started modeling in Europe for half the year and Cape Town for half of the year. Models sort of follow seasons around the world. There'll be like a season in Milan for a few months, and then Paris for a few months, or then London, and then South Africa, or things like that.
Yeah. Well, I heard you talking about that, and we'll get into the Nutella in a moment, but you made a comment about possibly being lonely, and it is an interesting thing because you hear some of these people when you actually talk to them that are at these pinnacle careers, whether it's movie star or successful model, and you would think the man or the woman that finds themselves there would be completely fulfilled. But what did you find about, you know, in the modeling specific? Like, was it fulfilling to you, or did you feel, you know, like you hear, for example, with these members of these bands that when they go on tour, it seems incredibly glamorous, but actually they find themselves very lonely touring, you know, away from their family for months and months and months.
Yeah. When I first went to Milan for my first sort of season in Europe, I did really well, a lot better than I expected. So the modeling side of it, like actually being there on the day and in front of camera and working with the team, I always loved. Sometimes it's really testing and really difficult, and you just feel like crying because it's a lot of pressure as a model. But most of the time I really loved it. But the scene around it, I really just did not like. Especially in Milan, there's so many old, creepy perverts, money. Like, they just get a whole lot of models to go out to dinner with them. It's so sad and so disgusting. And you just go out to dinner with these creepy old men. And then a lot of them go partying. They give you drugs. Nothing horrible ever happens. Nothing creepier than that. But I just wasn't interested in that whole lifestyle. And a lot of the time you have to stay in model houses. So the agency, if they know you'll do well in that specific market, they'll offer to fly you out. They fly you out and they'll put you in they probably own some apartments, and they just stack the models in there. It's normally two to a room. And I like my own space. I don't like sharing. And a lot of the times the models are really dirty. You know, I remember once staying in a model house, and there was some girls there that used tampons on the side of the bath. And I'm quite a really clean person, so I can't handle being around mess or anything. And a lot of those girls, a lot of them are young, but also a lot of them are very lonely. They're away from their boyfriends, away from their parents, so they feel quite sad. Sometimes you stay in a model house and it's really great, and you all get on like really good mates, and you sort of make friends for life. You go partying all the time, and it just depends. It's always different. But my favorite was to stay in Cape Town, because half of the year the modeling season was really busy in Cape Town. All the sort of northern hemisphere countries came to Cape Town to shoot in their summer. So it was perfect. It was really busy there, and it's such a good lifestyle. You could just chill at the beach, walk up the mountains. There's loads of sports to do there. It's always good weather. Really nice people around. And I suppose it was more my home. So, yeah, I felt better then.
Right. Well, that, I guess, leads us then to Nutella and your entrance into the martial arts. So I'd love to hear that story.
That's a weird way to get into martial arts. Yeah, I was in Milan, and I was staying with this creepy old man that owned the agency. Oh, man. But anyway, so I guess I was a little bit depressed. And so then I was like, oh, Nutella, that looks nice. I kept going to the supermarket and buying little tubs of Nutella. I could not stop munching it, probably because I was a little depressed. But, yeah, I couldn't stop munching it. And obviously I put on a little bit of weight. And then the little jars turned to big jars. And just munched away. And by the time I came home, I mean, I wasn't fat. But at the time you had to be very slim for modeling. So I put on a little bit of weight. And then when I got back, I was at a casting. And I was some models were talking about how to lose weight or some bullshit like that. And this one girl said to me, though, she started this thing called kickboxing. Down the road was at this quite like a grungy gym at the time. It was sort of behind a nightclub. She was like, hey, I'll just be on there. There's this little club that does kickboxing. Really good exercise. I was like, oh, I'll go down and give that a try. Yeah, so I went down, gave that a try once, and I was like, oh, my God, this is fucking amazing. So started going back like three times a week, and then started going back every day. And then, yeah, I started getting more and more into it. And then there's all these – you have like beginner's class and intermediate, and then you have advanced classes. And then I always used to watch, there's also a class called Fighters Class, which were very separate. Those are all, you know, the hobnobs, all the really good guys that used to fight. I always used to dream, oh, I'd love to be in the Fighters Class. So I was quite determined to get better and get in that class. So eventually I did get in that class. And eventually after 2 years, I wanted to start competing.
See, I mean, that's amazing that you just went for fitness originally. And, you know, as I'm sure we're going to talk about more, you know, your method of earning a living was aesthetics and how you looked. And then you got drawn into this beautiful art of Muay Thai, which, you know, undoubtedly every single class you walk away with bruises somewhere.
Yeah, there was loads of problems for some time because I always used to, I mean, not massive bruises, but you get a lot of, you block a lot in Muay Thai. So you get lots of bruises on your shins and lots of bruises on your hips or wherever where you get kicked. So sometimes my model agents used to get really pissed off. I actually got a message on Instagram the other day from a makeup artist that used to work with me. Jesus, I don't know, 18 years ago, 15 years ago or something. She said she always remembers working with me because she always had to cover up all the bruises. But it was always all right. It actually opened up quite an industry for me in modeling. Oh, sorry, my cat's climbing all over me.
No, you're fine.
It opened up an industry for me in modeling because I became quite sporty. I completely changed my type of body, actually. I've always been a really skinny person. Before that, I was pretty much like I am now, which not my muscle, some muscle, but not, you know, stacked, just really thin. And from loads and loads of training in Muay Thai, I actually become pretty muscular, but still slim, which you would have thought is not great for modeling. But actually, there's so many sports brands out there, you know, and there became loads of people that needed more sporty looking or healthier looking. So that was actually ended up quite good for me.
Right. Well, just to interject for a second. So you mentioned earlier in, you know, pre-Nutella, how everyone was, wanted to be very thin. I remember the waif models, you know, the Kate Mosses and all those. Yeah. And, how horrendous is that? Just as a woman in that industry specifically, what has been your observation of influences like martial arts, CrossFit, you know, mud runs, all these things of really redefining how a woman should look and what she should be able to do?
I mean, it definitely has changed. And I remember in those days, especially in the beginning when I was modeling, it was all sort of Kate Moss era where everybody needed to be super thin. And I guess it depends on the market where you're working. If you're working in Japan, you needed to be really tiny. If you're working, you know, in South Africa, it's more catalog industry, so it's more natural. So you could be a little bit healthier looking. Just depends. But it's definitely changed over the time. So obviously you got all those influences like CrossFit and just a healthier outlook on women's bodies. And it's definitely changed. You see a lot of the models you see now, even the supermodels, they'll be really in shape, slim, but they'll be really fit. Like they don't just starve themselves and go walk on the catwalk. They really train. So that is quite good, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think it is because they are, you know, role models for a lot of young men and women, depending on, you know, what the sex of the model is. And to have that role model be, as you're saying, someone who's healthy rather than someone who's just thin, really, I think, steers people down the right path. And unless I'm blind, it seems like the anemia, bulimia, anorexia, you know, I mean, not anemia, excuse me, the bulimia, the anorexia. I mean, they may have poor red blood cells as well, but but that era that you and I saw when we were young, you don't really see it anymore. And even as a paramedic, I rarely, rarely ever come across anyone who's got either of those diseases anymore.
No, I think I do hear of a few teenagers that have it. But I mean, fucking being a teenager is nuts anyway, I guess. There's a lot going on. But I think when it does happen, it's often just teenagers, like 16-year-olds or something.
Yeah, and that could be the exposure now on social media may have had another negative impact. But Yeah. All right. Well, so you didn't just train. You ended up actually becoming a fighter. So I'd love to hear about, you know, your fights in Cape Town and how that took you overseas as well.
Well, when I started fighting, I obviously started fighting in the amateur league. In Muay Thai, amateur league is when the women fight 4 rounds of 2 minutes. Sounds really short, but it feels like 4 hours a round. And you wear a headgear protection, a chest pad, I think, and shin pads, and then I can't remember what gloves, probably like 8 ounce or 10 ounce gloves. So you got quite a lot of protection going on. So I started in that league, and I fought one, my first fight, and I won, very happy. Then the second fight, I fought someone who was a bit heavier than me, and it did not go well. I've lost, and I got a black eye, which wasn't too bad, but I went to the toilet afterwards, and I was a bit upset that I'd lost, obviously, emotional. So I was crying a little bit, and then I needed to blow my nose. I'll give you some advice. If you ever got a ding on the eye, do not blow your nose. Oh, my God. I literally blew my nose, and in one instant, my eye popped out like a goldfish eye. Like just boom, popped out. My sister was watching, and her jaw just dropped. She's, oh, my fuck. So from that moment, I had big, like, bobble goldfish eye.
I think it was the UFC recently. I think Donald Cerrone had exactly the same thing. He was hit, and it looked like he fractured his orbit, but actually he said after, he's like, I literally just went to clear my nose and my eye ballooned up. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's mad. So that turned into a massive black eye. And yeah, well, I couldn't do any modeling for about 2 or 3 weeks. So that ended up in a bit of a fight between my model agency and my Muay Thai coach.
And then around that time, you're also exploring Buddhism, is that right? And that's what took you to East Asia?
Yeah, I guess it all just sort of happened. I didn't sort of start one thing and go into the other. It all sort of just happened, intermingled, I guess. So when I came out of school, we didn't really have I don't think we had cell phones at that time, maybe just those old school ones that messaged or called. So I started becoming interested in Buddhism. Oh, when I was in school, I watched the movie 7 Years in Tibet, which I love. And I don't know what it is, but as soon as I saw the scene of Tibet and I heard, you know, those Tibetan, I forgot what they're called, the big trumpets. I heard that sound and the sound of the drums and everything. Something drew me and I was like, fuck me, I have to go to that place. And since that day, it was my mission that I wanted to go to Tibet. Found out they were Buddhist, obviously, so started studying Buddhism. So for years through modeling, even my goal was to take 2 years off of modeling and go to study Buddhism. I wanted to stay in a monastery. Well, originally I wanted to go to Tibet, but then I found out that the China overtook Tibet and killed, raped, or kicked all of them out. So most of them live in India now. Saved enough money through modeling and headed out there.
Yeah, it's funny because I heard you mention that movie, you know, specifically in one of the other interviews that you did. When I was out living in Japan, I'll never forget. So the Japanese, obviously, you know, a lot of the stuff they speak is their own tongue, but there are some words that cross over that are basically mimicking English. And the right when I was over there, which was about 2000, 2001, it was on Japanese TV, and every time they were advertising it, it would always be Brad Pitt, 7 years in Tibet. So it was exactly, they hadn't changed anything, just stuck a few O's on the end of the word. So yeah, it always makes me laugh when I hear that specific movie.
That is funny.
So while you were traveling, you found yourself in Thailand.
So my main goal was India, obviously. I traveled around quite a bit for 3 months, all around, mostly in the north of India. And then I spent another 3 or 6 months, can't remember exactly. I'm just staying in this place called Dharamsala. It's in the foothills of the Himalaya. It's where the Dalai Lama lives. So it's big Tibetan community there and a lot of it's very open to Westerners coming to study Buddhism there. So I spent some time there. And then my sister and her boyfriend at the time were in, they were going on holiday in Thailand. So they said, oh, it's pretty close. Why don't you just pop over and say hello? So I did that. I popped over and said hello. And then a friend of mine also was staying in this island in Thailand on the eastern coast of Thailand called Koh Tao. So we all went there for a little holiday. And then I thought, oh, while I was there, I was like, oh, I could do with some training because I hadn't trained in like a year and I'd just been mostly meditating or just walking around. So I just wanted to move my body. So I thought, oh, I'll do some training. And they must have a Muay Thai gym here. So I found the only Muay Thai gym on the island. It's up this dirt road, like quite a bit into the, it's like inset into the jungle. Really cool. It's called Island Muay Thai. Pretty original. And so I went down there just to do some pads. And oh my God, I just loved the people. I did one session. And then the guy, the owner of the gym called Pitun, he said to me, hey, do you want to do a fight? But I think about 2 years had passed since I last fought, which is only amateur anyway. I'd only had three fights. So I was like, yeah, I'll do a fight. She's like, well, there's a fight in 10 days' time. Can you stay and do that fight? So I said, yeah, I'll do that. So I stayed, trained for 10 days and did a fight, won. And then he said to me, do you want to have another fight? There's another fight in 3 weeks' time. She's like, yeah, I'll stay and do that. So I ended up staying and doing that. And then I just absolutely fell in love with the people at the gym and ended up staying there for close on 2 years.
Wow. And then you were fighting under Muay Thai rules by that point. So no pads.
No, they don't have amateur in Thailand.
Right. So just gloves. That was it.
Yeah.
Right. So did you fight the whole 2 years?
I did. So you only fight about once a month, sometimes once every 2 months, sometimes you train for a fight 6 weeks ahead and then you get up to the day and then up to the week and the girl has to cancel and he can't find it, somebody else. So sometimes it'll end up a bit longer. But in general, the normal sort of thinking is a fight a month or every 6 weeks. So I had 25 fights in total. So that's been 22 fights out there. I stayed in Koh Tao for a couple of years and then I moved up to Bangkok because Bangkok's like where all the main fighting is. And it's the highest standard of fighting in Thailand. So I just wanted to up my game a bit. So I went to a gym in Bangkok.
Right. And then how did that go? Because as you were saying, that's kind of like the top tier when it comes to Muay Thai.
I actually can't remember all of my fights. I actually found a video the other day of a fight that I had in this place called Trang, which is in the deep south of Thailand, almost of Malaysia. And I remember the manager of the gym asked me for ages to go to, because he's from there. So we went and visited there, and I remember going there and seeing all the place and seeing they have a massive gym there, which is full of multiple champions there. But I don't remember fighting there whatsoever. But I've got a video. It says, like, fight in Trang. And I looked at it, and it's me fighting. I was like, my God, I do not remember that.
Well, you did have some trauma, though. So you're forgiven for not being able to remember everything. All right. So then, I know there's going to be a transition where you got into stunts. But what made you stop fighting ultimately? Was it the stunt work was more lucrative in the end? Or did you have a specific moment where you'd had enough?
Well, it kind of all happened at the right time because I was going out with this guy, like the main guy of the gym. His name was Anuak. He's quite a big superstar in Muay Thai world, especially in Thailand. So we were going out and things were getting a little fuzzy. So I just wasn't into the training that much. I started skipping a few sessions or not sleeping as well or whatever. So my fights got postponed. I just wasn't in it at that time. One thing you should never do if you really want to do well in sports, you should never fucking get a girlfriend or boyfriend because it really fucks things up. Yeah. So, but anyway, at that time, sometimes I used to still do modeling jobs because fighting in Thailand is never massive money unless you're a massive superstar, which is mostly only men, not women. And then it can be quite lucrative, but otherwise not very good money, which didn't bother me because you don't pay to live there. You live as a professional at the gym and they feed you and house you. So I didn't mind. I just loved it so much. But every now and again, I'd take a modeling job to get some extra bucks. I took a modeling job and we were shooting in Cambodia. And the guy that I was shooting with, the other model for the shoot, was a guy called Peter. And he was actually working in Bangkok. He lived there. And he was working as a casting director, well, on the casting team for a film that was filming there. He found out what I did and he's like, oh, they've been looking for this French film called Largo Winch, the second one. They're looking for this actress for ages and they can't find somebody. They need somebody that can do their own fighting stunts and other stunts. That obviously could act the part and have the look and everything. So we did a little interview, well, not an interview, casting in his room. And I ended up getting a job. So that was at the time where everything started getting a little fuzzy at the gym. So I decided I think I'll sort of move on now. And first I was still living at the gym and went in to do the days on the film. And then eventually my boyfriend and I broke up, so I moved out. I really just wanted my space and freedom then as well, because living in the gym, like being a woman in Thailand, you really have to be a woman. You have to dress in pink and you're not allowed to drink alcohol. And you have to really be girly. And I was just like over that bullshit by that time. So I was just like, I just want to be a normal Westerner now. So I got my own apartment in Bangkok and then just carried on filming really.
Wow. Now you said Anuat. Am I right in thinking that's one of the people that John Wayne Parr fought?
I don't know if they fought.
Because I do recognize the name, and I've got a few Muay Thai guys that I follow. But anyway, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, he's a huge star, isn't he?
On social media, he's very Thai, very. So he's not in any way on social media. But he is, yeah, Anuat KL Simrit is his name. He's a really great fighter when he was in his prime. Really good fun.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know we're not connected, but I know some of the people that I follow or have trained with are definitely trained with him as well or fought him. But but that's interesting because when I traveled, I went to drama school. I had a martial arts background as well. Did the sword training when I was in drama school. And then when I traveled the world, I got to Sydney, and Universal Studios, the theme park, was looking for stunt performers. And I ended up, you know, just literally being in Sydney, going, well, what have I got to lose? And I showed up, and it just happened that I looked like the bad guy in the Terminator 2 movie. So the same kind of thing. It's funny how you said that they were looking for certain, you know, looks as well with the skills as well. And I ended up falling in that role, which led me through, you know, not a long, long career in stunts, but definitely for about a decade. So, yeah.
Cool.
Right. So then, so you did the French film. So where did the stunts take you from there?
Well, obviously the French film was an acting role and I had to do my own stunts. So they had a really cool team of French guys out there and they literally spent days, weeks on weeks just spending all day trying to, it's quite a shift, as you'll know, from real fighting,
yeah,
fighting to screen fighting. And I actually, and also on the team was a really good Thai stunt coordinator called Seng Stunt. And so the Thai team and the French team, both great people. And I remember getting into such arguments with the French guys because I remember specifically once about a teep, you know, a push kick forward. Like do a push kick, so I push kick in part of the scene. And they're like, no, you're going up, don't go up on your toes. I was like, yeah, but that's how you push kick, how you teep. He's like, no, you don't teep like that. I was like, you do teep like that. And I used to get so pissed off because I was like, no, it's not proper. I remember once saying, because I used to speak quite fluent Thai, so he said to me in Thai, he's like, just go and cool down, go wait around the corner there and cool down. But yeah, it obviously took a little bit of a shift to get the performance side of it. Made things bigger, you know, and put more performance into it. But I loved that part so much, so I just really just carried on doing that. I made some good connections in Thailand. I still love living in Thailand at the time, so I did some more films with Singh and then met some of the other stunt people as you go, and then worked for the other stunt teams in Thailand. Yeah, I just kept on making connections and kept filming, really.
Brilliant. Now, you worked in Bollywood too. It's funny because I went around the world after I came out of drama school. We bought a round the world ticket. And my plan was, all right, I'm going to go to New Zealand. I'm going to work on Lord of the Rings, and I'm going to go to India, and they're going to pick me up as a Bollywood actor. None of that actually happened. It was all in my head. But you actually did. So what was working in Bollywood like?
Well, I did a couple of Bollywood films that used to come to Thailand, and then I actually went to Mumbai because Bollywood's from Mumbai. So I went actually and did some films. And actually, you know, if you do like a good Bollywood production, not a cheap, shitty one, they're actually a really well-produced film. And they're actually paid pretty well as well. So, yeah, I actually love doing Bollywood because it's so over the top. You know, a lot of these modern films, everything has to be so realistic. Everything has to be toned down, like a pre-production rehearsal time. So the stunt team always want to make, you know, great cool kicks and everything bigger because it's fun and it looks nice, but then it always gets toned down because now it has to be very realistic. Why would you do this fancy kick if you could just do a straightforward kick? But in India it's the complete opposite. It's hilarious because you don't just, somebody hits you with the left hook, you don't just sort of take a reaction with your head. It's a massive reaction with the head into a complete spin around the whole body and then drop to the floor. It's so funny. And they love it. Everything has to be massive and over the top. So the kicks, a lot of the stuff is even done on wire because you can't, not many people can do it in real life.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, did you ever have the yearning to go to Hong Kong? Because that was one of my younger dreams too, you know, seeing Gary Daniels and some of these English, you know, performers end up being bad guys in Jackie Chan's films, that one day that was my destiny too. I was going to be doing wire work with the Hong Kong team. So were you ever drawn to that side?
No, I wasn't actually. That's a little different because I think it's quite intense as well. I do know quite a few people that have worked in the Hong Kong industry and when it was massive, like in the 90s. And that is, it's a lot more intense. I think you really got to be on your game there. And really cool at its time. I think it seems to be making a bit of a comeback recently, I think. But yeah, I never had a drawing towards there really.
Right. So then a movie that kind of connects the two of us is Mad Max. So my friends, Pete Hill, Steve Dunleavy, I think Damian Bryson, so a lot of the guys I work with in Japan, ended up working on that production in Namibia. So how did you find yourself back in Africa to work on that?
Well, so I worked a couple of years in production, well, in films, in Thailand, and living in Bangkok. And then, you know, the city life just got too much for me. Like Bangkok is absolutely full on. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's intense. Like you could live for weeks in Bangkok and never touch the ground because everything can be above ground. It's so hot there and you're always just trying to hang out in shopping centers and somewhere where there's aircon. I just don't like city life and it's so intense after a while. Just people, millions and millions of people and cars and traffic wherever you go. So I just really craved going back to Cape Town and just, you know, living there. And I heard there was a film industry there. I knew a couple guys, those stunt people there. So I just gave them a shout. And then, yeah, I thought, oh, let me go and try and see if I can work in South Africa and get a bit of, you know, more natural lifestyle there. So I went back there in 2011. I spent a year there, which didn't go that great because at the time, females, I didn't have a lot of females that used to be in core teams. So there wasn't very stable sort of income. It was just every now and again. I ended up running, somebody asked me to run a boxing gym for them. So I used to run a boxing gym. And then in beginning of 2012 or end of 2011, after being there a year, I thought, oh no, you know, the industry is so much better in Thailand. I think I'm just going to go back there. So I went back to Thailand and when I was in South Africa, sorry, I did a casting for Mad Max. And you know how they had so many postponements. Like, I think they were postponed for like 13 years in the end. I just got loads of reasons, but they were supposed to start in 2011. So they had a casting in South Africa for some performers. I got the job, but they kept on delaying. So I thought, oh no, this is never going to happen. So I went back to Thailand and spent about 3 or 4 months there working. And then I got a call and said, oh, Mad Max is starting in a few weeks or a couple of weeks or something. So let's get going. So they were shooting in Namibia, which is just north of South Africa. So yeah, I went back there and stayed in Namibia for like 6 months.
Brilliant. Now, when you were on the set, obviously up to this point, you'd been using your martial arts as you know, your main stunt tool. How did you come across riding dirt bikes?
Well, actually, I wasn't doing that much Muay Thai. I was training it, but I've always loved to have like something that I'm so into. So I was so into Muay Thai, and I guess I craved being like really into something. So in a way, I was looking for something to really get into. And then when I did the casting for Mad Max and got that, they actually said to us, there's not going to be any female roles in the story. So what they might do with females is use us as pillions on the back of motorbikes, and because we're lighter. So some girls went on and got motorcycle licenses. I was like, nah, man, it's going to be in the desert. I was like, let's just stop motocross. And at the same time, I went and watched a stunt show, which is not really human stunts, but like some performers, it was more sports. So there was FMX and BMX and jet ski stunts and all things like that. And I saw the FMX guys. I was like, oh my God, that's fucking amazing. I want to do that. So thinking it's pretty much the same thing, I just started motocross. I said to my sister, I want to start motocross. She's like, oh, I know this guy. He rides motocross. His name's Babs. At the time, he was like 60 years old. And he still rides. He actually still rides to this day, and I think he's 66. He's fucking amazing, dude. So I gave him a shout, and I was like, oh, I want to start motocross. He's like, oh, come down. He had this old YZ125 from 1986. He's like, give that a go. So it's an amazing little bike. And so, yeah, off I went up and down the sort of dirt path for a while, and then eventually went onto the track and then started getting into the kit, buying my own kit. And then so eventually I wanted my own bike. And then just got absolutely obsessed with motocross. I loved it so much.
Yeah, I think that's an area that people don't understand about the stunt world is, you know, when you first go in, I know that the British one, I remember having a book like how to be a British stunt performer, and you had to be like gymnastics level 12 and, you know, all these things. But now, you know, you see that the martial artists do the fight scenes, and then the, you know, the X Games guys do the guys and girls do the you know, the motorized stuff, and the high divers are great at the falls, that there's all this you know, this specialization. So to be able to be well-rounded is definitely a goal for all of us. But ultimately, if it comes to a top stunt, you know, you need to find your lane, because the guy next to you or the woman next to you may easily be one of the top people in the world of that particular, you know, genre that they're in.
Yeah, I mean, there are quite a lot of specialists now, and that they use. It's great that coordinators normally prefer to use stunt performers, because if there's a stunt involved, the stunt performer has the performance side of it or knows how to perform. But a lot of the time, they do use specialists, so like specific motorbike stunt. Sometimes, like especially females, there's not a lot of females stunt performers who can ride really well, so they might bring in like a TT rider if it's specific road bike stuff, or a lot of the horse stuff's done by specific horse teams. And there are, so, you know, sort of some performers, they're really good trick riders on horses. So if they can, they'll use a stunt performer. But, yeah, they do use a lot of specialists now, which is good. It's safer.
Yeah, well, exactly. Now, speaking of stunt performer, and I saw the short video that you and you know, some of the other fellow stunt performers made about recognition of stunt performers in the movie industry. And it's an interesting thing because I've always been very anti-accolade in anything. And even the Oscars for the actors. A perfect example, Denzel Washington, name fell out of my head. He did Cry Freedom. He did so many of these incredible performances that he never won an Oscar for. I think it was Training Day he got one, which I don't think was one of his, you know, strongest performances by any means. This wasn't a strong script compared to some of the other ones. So it's kind of a, you know, a bullshit thing in the first place. However, you guys have a very good point where just pure recognition of the stunt performer, and we've seen a lot of these people who are the actors claiming they do their own stunts. And of course, if you're hanging from a wire 3 feet above the ground, then yeah, it's perfectly safe. But they're kind of negating all the things that you guys do. So what's your philosophy? Not so much on, oh, we need to get awards for it, but just being included in the overall production.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I've never been a big driver for it. Not like, you know, revved up about being awarded Oscars. I think it would never be for stunt performers anyway. It would be for like an action, maybe stunt coordinator, or maybe second unit director, probably stunt coordinator more. So it wouldn't ever take away from, like, you know, some people were worried, would it take away or, you know, show the fact that the actors aren't doing their own stunts. I don't think it would do any of that. And although I'm not a big, you know, forceful driver for the Oscars thing, I just don't understand why we're not included, because to me, all aspects of making a film should be included, you know, from lighting to directing to makeup to action to stunts. All of those departments take making a film. To make a good film, you need all of these departments to be in tip-top shape. And, you know, stunts work with the director and the producers right from the beginning through the whole film. And a lot of films nowadays, you take away the stunts, you don't even have a trailer. So, yeah, they do need it. So I don't understand why it's not included. But
yeah. Well, especially now because we have social media. I mean, you know, I follow Bobby Holland, who's Chris Hemsworth's stunt double. And they have, you know, they have a fitness app together. They got all kinds of things. But it's out that now, you know, that fourth wall's kind of been removed. So, you know, we get to see behind the scenes. Even the DVDs have all that behind the scenes footage. So it seems a little silly to not now acknowledge that community when we all are fully aware of who's truly doing the stunts. And then, you know, the areas where, you know, the some of these actors have got, you know, a great background in movement, but then it boils down to the insurance. They're not going to let them do it anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've been just going to steer it back down. Just acknowledging, it doesn't need to be an award, and I'm not about that, but yeah, you guys are a hugely important part of a car, especially when it comes to an action movie. If it's a drama and someone trips over a cat for 2 seconds in the movie, obviously that's not pivotal around stunts, but you bring in, you know, the Marvel movies and all those, that, you know, that's really a stunt movie with great actors involved as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I think it will get included one day.
Yeah, I think it should. All right, well, speaking of stunts, obviously with this, you know, we're going to have to discuss Resident Evil because that's a very pivotal point in your story, even though it's definitely not a defining point. So if you wouldn't mind kind of the how you got onto that particular project and then, you know, that awful, awful day when you were riding the bike on the bridge.
Well, that sort of happened. I was living and working in England since 2013. I came over here to shoot Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one. And then I met my husband, my now husband. And then so I fell in love with him and just wanted to stay living here in England. It's very big industry here in England, so I thought it's a good place to live and, you know, obviously stay with Dave. So we ended up getting married in 2015 in May. And there was a long time, which was a really shit time, because I couldn't I couldn't work in the UK because I didn't have a working visa. I went to South Africa to ride motocross for like a few months because it was their summer and it was cold in England. So I was like, I'm out of here. So I was riding in Cape Town for like 4 months, from October, November, December, and January. And then I was stuck there without a visa. I couldn't come back here to work because of my visa. But anyway, we're getting married in May. So we got married and then I think they lost my passport or something, but there was a massive delay in my spousal visa. So I couldn't come back here. And it was a bit of a shitter because I had booked a job here on the first Wonder Woman that I wasn't sure when I could come back because I wasn't sure when my passport would come through. So I wasn't actually working in South Africa. I was just riding motocross there, which I was a male element, so that was fine. While I was waiting for my visa and waiting to come and do Wonder Woman, obviously wasn't sure when the visa would come through, so I was asked to do a Resident Evil to double for Mila Jovovich. And it's not a great film, a bit of a shitter, cheap movie. But there were some really good, fun stunts to do on it. A lot of fun fights and some fun motorbike stuff. Well, I love both, so I was like, yeah, that looks good. And then I talked to Dave, my husband, for a while, and like, I don't know what to do because, you know, I've got Wonder Woman, which is a nice big film, but I don't know when my visa is going to come through. Or there's this one I could just start now, a Resident Evil shit film, but some really fun stunts. So then I spoke to the coordinator at the time for Wonder Woman, and I said to him about my situation. He's like, no, just do that Resident Evil job, and when you come back here in December when that finishes, then I just hop onto Wonder Woman. I'll put somebody else in your place in the meantime. So I was like, sweet, this is perfect. So, yeah, I took on Resident Evil, which was not a great idea, obviously.
Yeah, no, I mean, you weren't to know what was going to happen, though. So with that actual day, originally you had a fight scene planned. Is that correct?
I mean, on the day of accident, we're doing this quite a cool fight scene on top of a moving vehicle, like a big, don't what you call it, kind of like a lorry, but not very long, like a one-section lorry. A fight scene on top of that. So it was on the move, so we had to... And it was very difficult space to move on. Actually the scene was being shot the whole of the next week, and the whole of the next week was very sunny and hot. And that day, which was a Saturday, which was originally supposed to be a rehearsal day, but at last minute they were like, oh no, let's make it a filming day. So that was the only day, and then it was a break Sunday, and then film the whole of the sunny week. On that Saturday, it was absolutely poured down with rain the whole of the set. It was a Friday night, so everything was sopping wet in the morning. And then it was still drizzling and raining a little on the Saturday. So we were supposed to shoot the scene on top of the fight scene on top of the moving lorry, but we couldn't because it would be too slippery. So, you know what producers are like, they don't want to waste any time because everyone's there on the payroll. So they're like, ah, what can we shoot? Obviously not a great production, so they don't have weather options organized. So they're just like, unless can we shoot some motorbike stuff? Which is pretty fucking stupid because the motorbike stuff is pretty much the fight scene happens and then I jump onto this motorbike after I've killed the guy and I wheelie the motorbike off the lorry and go onto the road. So it's basically the scene directly after. So it's not like it'll be different weather. It's going to be the same weather. So in my head, I was like, oh, this is fucking stupid because you can't shoot that because it's the wrong weather and you're going to see, which is why.
So the two scenes wouldn't match up when you edit them.
Yeah, but I think you know what they like. They just want to do something because they don't want to waste their money. So... Yeah, so they asked me, is it okay if I do the motorbike stuff, which is fine. I don't mind riding in the rain. That's not a problem. So we decided to do some motorbike stuff.
Right. So the scene that you had shot up, it was on a railway bridge. Is that right?
There was that scene, the bike scene that we did. It was a very long road. I would say about 800 meters, maybe long. Two parallel roads, tar roads, a desolate road. So there's nothing on them. There was some car debris, you know, like they always do in films, broken down cars on the side of the roads. But it wasn't a used road. It was an old highway, I think. There's two parallel roads and a bridge on each end of it. And so we rode underneath the bridge. It wasn't on top of the bridge.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. So then as you're riding towards the film truck, there's a boom with a camera and it's supposed to basically go up and over as you go past.
Yeah.
All right. So my question, because I've heard, obviously, you know, I've seen the articles and everything, but I don't really have seen anything describing this. What the hell went wrong? Before we talk about what happened to you, why didn't that boom even raise up in the first place?
Well, there's loads of things that happened on the day where production went wrong, not organized, and risk assessments and things like that. But besides all that, like what directly happened was basically, as you said, I was to ride in a straight line. I had no helmet on, riding a straight line along the road, and in the opposite direction came the action vehicle's car, with a crane to the side of it at the time and a camera on the end of that crane. The camera is supposed to start scooping along the floor. And then as it comes close to me, it's supposed to lift up and over the top of my head. But the guy who owns the action vehicles company and this is a guy that was responsible for lifting the crane. Him and the driver basically just fucked up, went completely freestyle and just didn't lift the boom in time and lifted it too late and smashed it into my head and top of my shoulder.
Right, and this was a cumulative speed, you know, opposing of over 100 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, which is quite scary if you think about it. I've no helmet on. I was riding at about 70 kilometers an hour and they were opposing at 50 kilometers an hour. So that's like in conjunction 120 kilometers an hour with no helmet, just something going straight into my head. So it's fucking amazing that I'm still alive, really.
Yeah, because I mean, as we know basic physics, that would be the same as you driving into a bridge at, you know, 80 miles an hour, whatever it ends up being through our system, to a dead stop.
It's crazy if you think about it that way.
Yeah, no, it is. So, if you wouldn't mind just kind of walk us through, you know, what you remember of that and then obviously the resulting injuries from that horrendous impact.
I don't remember. Apparently, I was conscious and trying to get up, but I must have just, you know, like my left-hand side of my face was totally degloved, which just means pulled back so you could see my teeth through my cheek. And loads of injuries. I was apparently still trying to get up and a little bit conscious. I don't remember that. I do remember literally 1 second of being put into the ambulance and seeing the roof of the car. I didn't know what was happening, but I remember them. And then, yeah, I just, you know, loads and loads of horrific nightmares in the coma, which is literally like going to hell. And then I woke up and then to see my family's and my husband's face, which was about almost three weeks later.
That's crazy. Absolutely crazy. It's amazing that you were even up. I mean, coming from the paramedic background, you know, the impact that you had, you know, like you said, it should have killed you. And obviously, you know, what you're left with physically is not, you know, a complete, fully formed, you know, functional body again. But, you know, the fact that you didn't die right there on an impact is, I mean, really defies all, you know, biomechanics and physiology, really.
Yeah. Well, the surgeons kept saying that if I wasn't, because I always had a very strong back and my shoulders, you know, the back part of it, obviously from loads and loads of Muay Thai over the years. And he said that if I didn't have such a strong back, my whole shoulder would have ripped off completely on the site. So I would have had no shoulder or anything. Because I can't, my shoulder blade was shattered. You said the pressure that is needed to shatter a shoulder blade when you get hit from the front of the shoulder is very, very rare because it's got that much. It's so strong, you know. But basically all my shoulder muscles were strong enough to hold it all together. So although it shattered, it was still held together and it eventually fused in like a completely wrong, in a completely wrong way, which we sorted out later. But yeah, and I think I was very healthy. I've always been really into nutrition and in peak shape. So I think that helped really a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure it. I had several people on here that have been through all kinds of stuff, from, you know, a mountain bike accident where the saddle went right into their femoral artery branch, and all kinds of people. And again, each one of those, they were told that they were safe because of that, because of their physical condition. If they'd been deconditioned, they would have bled out right there and then.
Yeah. Mad.
All right. So then, a big part of obviously your post incident injury was that one arm. So I know it was completely decimated. I know there were parts of your arm I didn't even find, but it was still intact. So what was that journey for you, from hoping that you were going to be able to rehab that arm to ultimately losing it?
Well, in the beginning, like when I was still in a coma, they said to my husband and family, like her arm, everything actually on my left hand side, including my neck, is paralyzed, and there's no way, it's impossible for it to ever get better. It will never get movement again, because all the nerves that feed my left hand side, besides my top left hand side, all those nerves were pulled out of my spinal cord by the root. So there's no way that they can put them back in, or there's no way that they can grow back in. So they were told still when I was in coma that it's not possible for it to get better, but they didn't, I guess nobody had the courage to tell me that. And my husband was so determined that we could find somebody somewhere in America or the UK or anywhere in the world. Like, he was just looking and speaking to the top surgeons, to hopefully do something. But eventually, I guess there was a little time where there was a little hope in. And eventually we figured out that there's literally nothing you can do. Because my injuries are so complex. There's so many injuries. And, you know, they're so extensive that there's just literally nothing you can do. And anyway, at the same time, like while I was, when I came out of a coma and eventually moved into a normal ward, I had to learn to walk again. Eventually learned to walk again, and I could just really feel the weight of my dead arm, because you've got the whole of your top left-hand side completely dead weight. And my God, my arm, when they eventually chopped it off, it was like 4 kilograms that they took off. You took 4 kilograms of dead weight hanging on my neck, my shoulder and my neck, which is also paralyzed. I just could not take it. And that was really holding me back. And eventually when I could go home and try and sort of get more normal life back together, like the thing that was really holding me back was the weight of my arm. There was no way that my arm would ever work again. And the arm completely atrophies. There's nothing left. It was just literally bone and skin covering it. And then some parts of it, as you said, they were never found. So I had like missing fingers, which looked really weird. And some of them were so mutilated that they were curled over and they could never go straight. It just looked like a big claw. And then, parts of the forearm, like 9 centimeters of the forearm bone, was missing. So they had to replace that with a piece of cement. And they said, to replace it, they have to take one of your lower leg bones, entire bone, to replace that piece. And I was like, no, man, this arm's never going to work. It's holding me back. I could not even stand up for like a minute because of the weight on my neck, hanging on my neck. So I was like, I just want to take the arm off. Like, it's not going to do anything. It just looks like big dead claw. So, yeah, I was I insisted that I wanted to take the arm off and just move on with my life. But that actually took quite a while. I'd say it took about 6 months. I was back in the UK at the time. And they really wanted to make sure that, obviously, you can't reverse it. If you take your arm off, they can't put it back on. So they really wanted to make sure that that is the right decision that you're positive on. So I had to go for all psychological sort of sessions with a specific amputation guy, make sure that I was in the right headspace to do it. Yeah, and then about 6 months later, they're like, cool, let's do it. So I went and got the chop, and that was actually the best day since the accident when I took my arm off.
Yeah, and it's so strange to hear that, but I mean, the way you describe it makes perfect sense. You know, if that's not functioning as your arm anymore, then it is, you know, dead weight, and it's now hindering you. But what a challenging decision to make, to remove something that, you know, you've had obviously since you were born, and for that to ultimately be, you know, the beginning of moving forward is a very powerful moment.
Yeah, like so many people, I said what I was going to do, and so many people were like, no, don't chop your arm off. And I was like, they just don't understand. But you know, for me, the biggest problem with the accident was the change of life that I had to have. You know, from having a very active, outdoor, full life to having, you know, to not hardly being able to stand up at the time or do anything. That what was so difficult for me, more than the, you know, change of my body or a possible loss of an arm. So that's what I really wanted to get back, was some kind of happiness and some kind of, you know, life where I could move or stand up, at least make myself something to eat or anything, you know. I had to help people help me all the time. I could never be left alone. So I was just like, I weighed it up and I definitely just wanted to get rid of it. So
yeah. Well, what's interesting as well, looking at you from the outside looking in, is, oh, there's, you know, Olivia, she lost an arm in an accident. But then when you see the x-rays and you talk about the internal, you know, trauma on the spine and, you know, the nerves, your spine looks like an S shape, you know, completely distorted. So there's so many injuries that are hidden by your body that you're dealing with as well. Is that something that you struggle with? Is, you know, people think, oh, you know, that's your only limiting factor, whereas your internal battle is obviously all these other things that are going on as well.
Yeah, you know, the, like having one arm for me is seriously not a problem. If I had a normal, strong body, there's no problems, I had one arm, it wouldn't bother me whatsoever. I'd still be doing stunts and still be doing all the other things that I love to do. The thing that really holds me back, and this biggest, you know, bane in my life is the paralysis. And that the paralysis on the core and the neck especially caused the spine to move in so many directions. So it's, you know, bent in all sort of uncomfortable directions. And paralysis itself is so painful. I always thought if you see someone when I never knew anything about it, I'd see someone in a wheelchair and I would think that their whole body was numb and heavy. But it's so painful. It's constant without a second's break pain. And that's hard to live with. And also, you know, the constant spasming and twisting of the body is also very hard to live with.
So as you said, you were this, you know, able-bodied stunt performer using their body for their profession. You have this horrendous accident. And you find yourself now, what has been your self-talk? How have you been so resilient and fought your way back to where, you know, we're watching videos of you doing martial arts again?
Well, as I said, I love sports and I love digging my heels and really being like getting into something 100%. So, you know, obviously Muay Thai is not a great option for me now because it's quite a hard sport and martial arts, and in fighting I had to change stance because there's nothing on my left hand side to protect myself, so I had to change to a right foot forward stance to southpaw, which is a massive change anyway. So there's a guy that I used to train with actually to get better at just sort of different kicks when I was doing stunts, And he's got a gym just down the road, which is perfect for me. He's an amazing teacher. So yeah, I spoke to him and he was like, yeah, let's do something. So, and he does kickboxing, which is quite a very different style to Muay Thai, but it's absolutely perfect for me now. Yeah, so I went and down and did that and yeah, I just got into it. And the good thing about kickboxing is it has a belt system. So Muay Thai, you don't have any belt system. You just get in the ring and you fight and you train for your fight. And then you can get championships. But in kickboxing, you have belts. You do have tournaments as well, but you can work from yourself from white belt up. In our school, there's 8 belts up until a black belt. So that gives me nice little goals to work for, which is cool. So at the moment, I've worked myself up to purple belts. So I've only got brown belts and then black belts.
Very nice. You know, watching the footage of you training, it reminded me, have you ever heard of the guy Bill Superfoot Wallace from back in the day?
No.
So I think he did a couple of, like Jackie Chan style movies as well. I think he was in a couple of his, but he was a judo player before and got thrown and completely messed up one side of his body. So he ended up, I think it was right side forward. He could only kick with his right leg and then would use his right arm. And he ended up being a world champion kickboxer. And he just had, I think it was the side kick, the round kick, the hook kick, and then, you know, like jab, cross, uppercut with his hands as well. So it reminded me a lot of that, watching you train.
I mean, I don't know. I can't even remember his names, but I saw there's actually a documentary on Netflix. It's a black guy. I think he's from America, I think. And he does wrestling. Have you seen him? He's got no legs.
Next, yes. Yeah, no big, legs. Big Z. Yep.
Yeah, that's his name. It's incredible.
Yeah, actually, he's one of the people I'd probably try and get to one day on here. But yeah, I mean, it's not even like, you know, below groin. I mean, he stops kind of at the belly button almost, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he looks like he's got no hips, but he has hips. He's just literally no legs.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. So that's it. So that's what I want to ask you as well. From the physical side specifically, you know, there's no good time for this to happen to you, to your own personal journey. However, in the sports exercise community, this is a great, great time for adaptive athletes. I think sadly that's probably a lot to do with so many of the IED, the patients that we've had come back from the Middle East. Did you, when you actually got hurt, find there were some great resources because of that to work around? For example, I think I saw the picture of you doing the one-armed jump rope that you see a lot in the games now.
Oh yeah. That actually my husband found on social media, on Instagram. So there's a few great one-arm people to follow on Instagram that he followed. And there was this one guy, I don't actually know his name, but he's great on that rope. Like he does double jumps. It's like, wah, 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 just double jumping the whole time. It's incredible. So my husband contacted him and was like, hey, where did you get that cool rope from? So first we made a DIY one, which was pretty sketchy. the pole that we got from the shop and then put a like tie jump rope onto it. But then he got one from the guy in the States. And so there is a lot of that opening up. And actually, like the weird thing is I've started modeling again, believe it or not.
No, that's brilliant.
That whole industry's really opened up. And a lot of the, you know, even I don't really go into shops that much, but I do a lot of online shopping, even clothes. So you look at a lot of these websites now, it's all like, you know, really trying to open themselves up. There's a lot of, you know, slim people and overweight people, people with skin problems, or is it albinism?
Oh yeah, the albinos.
Yes, albinos. Mm-hmm. Sorry. People and lots of people with, you know, limb differences. You see a lot of that nowadays. So that's worked out pretty well for me. So I've done saw a bit of modeling, and the other day I did a bit of acting.
And what was that in?
That was for a TV commercial for the UK, for the census for the UK. I had to do a one-armed pull-up.
Brilliant. Yeah, like I said, I've had so many different people on here that have lost limbs from a variety of reasons. It reminded me of one guy, Mitch Dreyer, who was actually my very first guest on this podcast, was a fireman where a building collapsed on him. And he, you know, got burnt so horrendous he lost one arm. And I met him in Edo Portal workshop, and he was one of the only people in the room that could do just what you said, a one-arm pull-up. So, you know, it's funny. People look at a person and be like, oh, they've got a disability. You're like, no, they've just found a way to get even stronger with what they've got left.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. Well, then, speaking of the healing, I know, I mean, obviously this mental journey has been very tough for you, but an area that I'm actually about to talk about even in more depth in a few weeks on this show is equine therapy. So you've kind of traded out the motorbike for the horse. So I'd love to hear about your journey into that.
Well, actually, I work a little bit. I just literally help somebody out with some equine therapy. It's every Monday, but sometimes you only do once a month. I'm at the horse riding school that I ride at. And they do equine therapy with people with dementia, and sometimes just old people, and sometimes severely handicapped people. And we just get them to come over, and we give them proper British stuff like tea and cake or cookies, and sometimes scones. Then we bring out some horses, you know, that are really good with people, and some of them are really, you know, they just want to look them fast. Some really love to touch them and rub them on the noses. Some of them even that can walk, they'll sort of walk them around. It's just such a nice day for them to get out and do something different, be outside and see the horses. They all love telling the story of 1940 when they used to ride horses, and some of them bring these amazing photographs when they're still in side saddle and long dresses. So funny.
It's amazing. Yeah, when you see that, you know, the healing power of dogs, of horses, and even some of the people that dive that are able to swim with you know, mammals in the ocean. But there is such a powerful connection between, you know, a healing animal and a person that's looking to be healed.
Yeah, I've always loved animals. Any animals of any type, except for insects. Don't like insects.
If you grew up in Africa, there's probably some pretty hateful insects there. Yeah, I've got
animals. They're really cool. Like, I've got two Maine Coon cats, and I love them so much. They give me so much joy in every day. It's not a day they don't make me really laugh out loud. It's cool.
Well, with the horses, have you seen a documentary called Buck, B-U-C-K?
I've either seen it or I've seen the trailer, but I've definitely seen something about it.
Okay. In the documentary. Yeah, so it's about basically there's not just one guy, but one of the horse whisperers, and his name's Buck Brannaman, and he, when he was very young, he was in a very abusive household. His father made him and his brother be like performing cowboys that were on TV doing, you know, trick lasso work. You know, he ended up getting away from his father and becoming this incredible horseman. And that horse, you know, the relationship with the horse basically was his healing. And then now he's this incredible person that's showing these riders, these horse owners, that, you know, a lot of the problems they're having with their horses because of the way they're treating the horse or the way they're dealing with their own anger. And so I'm actually going to Georgia next month to sit down with him. So that's going to be a fascinating thing, because, I mean, not only did he heal, but he ended up being a teacher for all these other people as well.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm actually I was supposed to do a course in June, but then I ended up having to have an operation, which ended up postponing at last minute. So I postponed the course as well, but the course is now happening in September. And that's a course on natural horsemanship, which I'm sure the guy knows or understands or does himself. And that's just a really natural way of, you know, either, you know, healing horses that have problems or just training horses. It's really beautiful. It's amazing. I love it. I'm looking forward to them.
Yeah, no, that sounds exactly what it is. And are you able to ride yourself? Because it seems like it would be a lot easier to ride a well-trained horse than trying to navigate a dirt bike.
Yeah, definitely. It's because they have their own minds and their own moods. You know what horses are like. It's not just throttle on or throttle off. So, But I love it. Yeah, definitely. Right. I ride twice a week, and I love it every time. And there's 25 horses where I ride, so pretty much ride a different horse every time. And every time you climb, even on the same horse, it's different. You've got to feel how they are on that day, what mood they're on, depending on the weather or what's going on around them. Like, so many things can make it different. But I absolutely love it. I love the personalities and the characters of each horse.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to transition to some closing questions to be mindful of your time. But the first thing that I normally ask about people, recommend the book, but I know that you're in the process of writing a biography. Is that right?
Well, I'm not writing one because I couldn't write anything. There's a writer. She's from New York. Her name's Shannon. Shannon Nixon. She approached me some while ago. She actually, I don't know where she heard about me from, but she actually trains Muay Thai. She loves it. She had one fight as well. And she asked me if she could, she was interested in writing a biography on me. So I was like, yeah, that sounds amazing. So we've been working together, I don't know how long now, maybe 2 years, I think, or a year, I don't know. But we just spent hours talking over Skype, and she's obviously learned pretty much my entire life in the last couple of years. So she's written the book. I don't know when it's coming out quite yet, because it is almost ready. There's just a few things, legal stuff that we're waiting on, because we want to obviously include all the details of the accident and stuff. So it just depends on, we've got to wait for a few legal things so that we're allowed to incorporate all of the details.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, let me know as soon as it does, and I'll definitely post about it here. And I'm sure people listening are wondering as well. I know after the accident, you know, there was the question of you know, who made the mistakes and at least some sort of compensation. Have you able to secure that yet, or is that still in the air?
That's a really dark, dirty, disgraceful situation. All those details will be in the book. And we're also busy shooting a documentary. Also another guy from the States, he approached me. I shot actually another documentary with him about stunts. And then he wanted to do a story on just myself. So we've been doing that. And he's also in post-production at the moment. So those will probably come out more or less the same time, I think.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, let me know and I will definitely make sure that the audience knows about those as well. All right. So then, as I said, so is there a book that someone else has written that you love to recommend? It can be about what we talked about today or something completely different.
Well, I read a lot of books, but I generally, pretty much all the time, I only read Buddhist books. So I don't know if that would, I'd recommend those to the general public.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right. And then what about a film? Do you have a favorite film?
Well, I think one of my favorites is still 7 Years in Tibet, because I love it, although it's old now. Don't know. Oh, I just love Game of Thrones. That's it for me. I absolutely love Game of Thrones. I recommend anybody to watch that. It's got nothing to do with what we talked about, but it is good.
Yeah, no, it seems like most people have seen it. I'm one of the few that haven't, but we're going to binge on it, you know, at one point, pay for the HBO.
It's so good.
All right, what about a documentary? Do you have a documentary that you love?
Don't know. I'm actually not, you know, it's a bit weird, but I'm not actually that into documentaries. Sometimes I do. My husband loves documentaries, but I don't like watch them that much, because most documentaries that you watch are made to sort of, they're intended to invoke some sort of feeling, you know, of you. And a lot of them is like about a sad situation or a crazy situation. So it invokes a lot of feelings of you thinking, oh, what the fuck? Well, that's crazy. Or, you know?
Yeah.
So I tend to stick away from that. I just like good old films where it's about a story that's nothing about real life and you feel good at the end.
All right. Well, we did talk about Big Z's documentary, so I can pop that into The Wrestler. Yeah. Brilliant. All right. So the next question, is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders and military of the world? And again, it doesn't have to be specific to that community. It can be anyone, stunt world, anyone.
No, don't know. quite a cool stunt performer, if you're interested in female stunt performers, is a girl. She's from the States, Jessie Graff. Do you know her?
No, I don't.
She's a stunt performer, good stunt performer, and she's also really well known for being a ninja warrior. I think she won last year.
Oh, okay. Brilliant.
That's so cool, yeah. She looks like, I've never met her, she looks like a really nice girl and super fit. Love watching her Instagram stuff because her fitness is just on another level. It's amazing.
Yeah, that is. Absolutely. All right, well, I have to look her up. Thank you. All right, so then the very last thing before we talk about where people can find you online, what do you do to decompress?
Well, I normally meditate every morning for about half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, depending on how I'm feeling. And that sort of gives me a good start for the day and just sort of calm my mind down and focus on what's going on inside of me. I always love to do sports, especially horse riding, to decompress in any way. If ever I'm stressed and I know I've got a horse riding session, I relax because I know that I feel better afterwards. Yeah, and sometimes even watching films is good. If you've got something you can't stop thinking about or stressed about, sometimes it's just good to watch a film and you completely don't think about it. And by the end of it, you know, you're not so stressed about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. All right, so then the very last question then, if people want to find out about you online or on social media, where are the best places to go?
Well, I'm not on Facebook because I'm actually not a huge social media fan. I'm a little old school. I think I just want to move to a farm and completely go off the internet and raise some sheep and some horses. But yeah, I'm still on Instagram. I think my name's Olivia the Bandit because I'm a one-armed bandit. Yeah, and that's about it, really. Just Instagram.
Brilliant. Is it Olivia Biography is the one that's attached to the book? Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. Olivia Biography.
All right. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. And, you know, I know, like a lot of people I have on here, I know it's not easy to relive and recount, you know, some of the more challenging parts of your story. But it's just so amazing to watch you grow every day physically, you know, and I'm sure mentally as well, from an injury that, you know, I think would have killed many people. And then, you know, psychologically would have, you know, stop them from growing as well. So I just really, really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.